Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
11% of women in Connecticut live in poverty. Eviction levels are higher than they were pre-pandemic, and evictions disproportionately affect women and their families. During and after the peak of the pandemic, a shortage in childcare led many women to reduce their hours or leave work altogether. This is Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Those are just a few of the topics that we covered at a recent live event at Quinnipiac University. The event coincided with the release of a new report called Elusive Equity, Continuing Effects of the Pandemic on Women's Economic Security. The report was written by Connecticut Data Collaborative and funded by Aurora Women and Girls Foundation and the Community Fund for Women and Girls of the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. This hour, we'll discuss the ways that housing, childcare, and economic mobility impact women in our state. Later in the show, we'll hear from a panel about what we can do to address these challenges. But first, let's start with the data in the report. Michelle Reardon-Nold is Executive Director of Connecticut Data Collaborative. The organization works to connect people with data to help them make informed decisions. Jenny Stedman is Executive Director of Aurora Women and Girls Foundation. It supports women and girls through grant making, research, and education. I started by asking Michelle why choose to write the report now when it seems that so many people have just moved on from the pandemic.
Well, I think just exactly what you said is that people have forgotten, right? They think we saw high unemployment rates for women during the pandemic, and now we're back to levels seen prior to the pandemic. So things have opened up. So there's sort of forgetting what did happen and what is happening. If you look at evictions, for example, they're higher than they were pre-pandemic. We're at 23,000 evictions in 2022, whereas before the pandemic, it was 19,000. So even we're not hearing about evictions because we had stopped the support for people, but it's still happening, right? And so that was why it was important to write this report, is to look and see, did anything change? Have we disrupted what we had seen during the pandemic?
Jenny, the Aurora Foundation is one of the funders and supporters of this report. And there's a lot of alignment with the work that you do in community and also through your organization. There are so many areas that one could cover. I'm curious how you decided collectively that these are the areas that we want to put forth as priorities, but also seeing how it helps us get a foundation for addressing this topic.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key piece of why to do research like this is really to make women visible, right, in ways, particularly Black women, Latina women, how we can make their experience kind of rise to everyone's attention. And I think that's exactly what CT Data is engaged in when they talk about data as a way to get at equity. So when we're thinking about tonight, we're going to particularly be talking about childcare and access to childcare. We're going to be talking about housing, as Michelle already mentioned. CT Data has done some excellent work on the eviction crisis in Connecticut where we had a situation where the state didn't collect the gender and race of those facing eviction, right? So then they're literally invisible. So they went through every case since 2017 to determine the gender and race. And it didn't surprise us that it showed a disproportionate impact on women of color. But we knew that the people that get to make the big decisions, that would be a surprise to them. So when we can document, when we can provide this kind of very necessary data, then we have a place to start to make change.
One of the other things in the report is that it provides data not just about the state as a whole, but you're able to show where concentrations of challenge are happening across the state. Connecticut is a small state,
But when you look at this data, the problems are massive in towns like New Haven, Bridgeport, Waterbury, but also some of the rural areas where access to opportunity is a key thing there. I'll ask both of you, first to you, Jenny, how do you think that it helps us make the case for why we need targeted, localized solutions that are funded or supported at the state level, but really not assuming that a one-size-fits-all approach can meet some of the needs that Michelle mentioned?
You know, I think that really kind of tags into women's funds and the way that we are so kind of embedded and local in communities. So that, you know, that's kind of second nature to us, I would say. But I think, you know, looking at the report also is, I think, makes pains to point out the contributions that women make to Connecticut's economy. So when I think about an argument to people who have power or who are making decisions, I really think looking at women and girls through an asset lens that talks about, here's what you lose if we don't have these solutions, here's what this contribution means to all of us, then you get to something that's much more, I think, is an argument that is convincing.
Michelle, let me ask you the same question. How does that help us?
So let me share some data about the nuances that we're talking about. So there was recently a report about that showed that 80% of college-educated women with children under the age of 5 are in the workforce. And that is actually something to be proud about, because it was 77% before the pandemic. But then if you look at women mothers with children less than 5 who have a high school degree or less, you're talking about 54% are in the workforce. And that actually is a drop from 56%. So when we're thinking about, you know, our, you know, is it childcare solutions? Is it the wage gap, right? We have to think differently about which population, and we should be serving all populations of women, right? And if you think about, we have 40% of the workforce, women, 40% are employed in the educational services and healthcare sector. So that's not a sector that can work from home, that needs different childcare options. So we have to think about multiple solutions, right, to approach the problem.
So in your report, Michelle, you also talk about educational attainment, that you have more women going to college in Connecticut, but that also means that there are more women who are shouldering crippling student loan debt. And so even when they are able to make it into the entrepreneurial sector or be able to excel in these ways, they are starting at a disadvantage when it comes to building that generational wealth for themselves or for their families. What would you say is a takeaway as we think about all of these interconnected pieces that you mentioned, right? Housing security, being able to have access to childcare. And I would say for many people, it's access to elder care as well now. And being able to have a start with education, what would you say is a key takeaway for us when we think about this report and the data it reveals?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's the intersectionality of the issues, right? That we can't just approach childcare alone or housing alone, that it's or the workforce alone. It's all together, right? Because they're all building off one another. Like you said, you know, it's great. We should celebrate that 60% of enrollment in undergraduate colleges are women, are females, and 63% graduate students in Connecticut are females. But like you said, what does that mean for then entering the workforce in terms of the student debt? So it's really the interplay of how all of these issues come together, and really thinking about people as a whole, right, and not our individual systems and silos that we've established.
That was Michelle Reardon Nold, Executive Director of Connecticut Data Collaborative, speaking at our recent live event at Quinnipiac University. We also heard from Jenny Stedman, Executive Director of Aurora Women and Girls Foundation. We'll post a link to the Elusive Equity Report on this episode's website. You can find it at ctpublic.org/disrupted. Coming up, a panel of community leaders discusses policies that are working to improve the lives of women across Connecticut. This is Disrupted. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Today we air a live event that I recently hosted at Quinnipiac University. We started by unpacking some of the statistics on women's economic security in Connecticut. And so now we hear from leaders in our state who are working in the areas of housing, economic mobility, and childcare. We're back with Jenny Stedman, Executive Director of Aurora Women and Girls Foundation. She's joined by Karen Lott, Executive Director of the Women's League Child Development Center. The center provides childcare in Hartford and emphasizes affordability and research-based education. Karen also serves on the board of Aurora Women and Girls Foundation. Emily Byrne is Executive Director of Connecticut Voices for Children. It's a research and advocacy organization that's working to improve the lives of Connecticut families. And Dr. Karen DuBois-Walton is President of Elm City Communities. The agency consists of the Housing Authority of New Haven and two nonprofit organizations. They operate and develop affordable housing in New Haven. Between 2019 and 2022, about 50,000 evictions were filed against women. That's according to the report that we discussed earlier. I started the panel by asking Dr. DuBois-Walton about leading New Haven's Housing Authority and seeing that tremendous need every day.
The pandemic really shone a light on an experience that families were experiencing well before that, and that has continued well after that. And that is the crisis of housing unaffordability in our community, which boils down to a couple of key facts: that incomes are not rising as quickly as rents, and that gap between what families can afford and what's coming home every day in a paycheck is just becoming wider. That is particularly evident for Black and brown female-headed households, where we know that the work that where women predominantly are in are some of the most lowest paid roles. All of this focus on essential work that we heard during the pandemic, we're not hearing much about that anymore. And it also didn't translate into higher incomes for families. The pressures on this market have resulted from the fact that for decades we've underproduced housing. So we have a real supply and demand issue. And the families that feel at the worst in a crunch-like market are those at the lowest income. And that is disproportionately Black and brown women. We see that every day in the 6,000 families that we are working to keep housed that we serve. But we also see it in the 30,000 families that are on the wait list for our agency alone.
Wow.
And it speaks to this very core issue that incomes in our community have not kept pace. Connecticut is actually the ninth most expensive place mm-hmm. to try to live. And it's leaving thousands of families really housing with housing instability. And that's a crisis around how am I going to keep a roof over my head? You think about the emotional toll that takes. If you have ever had to worry about a bill, if you have ever tried to duck the bill collector, if you've ever worried about, you know, whether you're going to come home and there's an eviction notice on your door, all of that amps up a level of anxiety in you. It impacts your ability to cover your other expenses. What you're struggling to put toward your rent when you're paying what we call rent burdened means you're paying more than what you can afford for your housing. That means other things are suffering. It also means you pay more fees, more fines. It is expensive to be poor. Mm-hmm. You are then, you know, inheriting all of those. So it becomes a cycle that results in challenges to your keeping your work, challenges for your kids being able to be stable in school, and all of these ramifications we're seeing of the fact that people are just struggling to afford to live in our communities.
Emily, I was struck by what Karen just said about 30,000 families on the wait list. Mm-hmm. And you multiply that times however many people are in the household, and it becomes even bigger. Connecticut is a state where the words entrepreneurship and innovation get used all the time, mm-hmm. right? 96,000 open jobs, entrepreneurship is the way to go. And I wonder from your vantage point, what you're seeing when it comes to economic mobility for women, mm-hmm. that even as these things are happening, these programs, these opportunities, from your vantage point, what does that look like for women in Connecticut?
Yeah, so it's a great question. You know, as a state, Michelle touched upon this earlier, for women, the labor force participation rate, is actually almost where we were pre-pandemic. We were at 60.8% in February of 2020, and in April of 2023, we were at 59.4% for women. That said, the men's labor force participation rate is about 10 points higher than women's, and so we do still have work to do. Additionally, the gender wage gap ranges from 93 cents on the dollar at the 10th percentile, where the hourly wage is $14.10 in Connecticut, and 78 cents on the dollar at the 80th percentile, where the hourly wage is $48.08 in Connecticut. The smaller gap, I think, here for the low-wage workers is due in large part because of the minimum wage, which really sets the floor for wages for workers. And the larger gap at the middle wage for middle-wage workers is really indicative of the intersectional gender norms that we see in terms of household duties and childcare. When we look at wages by race and ethnicity, the divides are even wider, with white workers, disproportionately occupying the highest wage jobs. And then, of course, you add on our tax structure, which is regressive. We know that, and these are national numbers now, that childcare prices have increased on average 80% since 2005. And this impacts women's labor force participation rate, as we know. We know that women and women of color are disproportionately renters, and that rent prices have increased by 85% since 2005. And as Karen just pointed out, we know that eviction numbers are climbing as a result of people unable to afford the skyrocketing rents. So in addition to evictions being disproportionately on women of color and young children. So you can hear the problems are not just intersectional, they're layered. And we haven't yet established, and you pointed this out, Kalila, the patchwork of policies that dramatically stop these vicious cycles to say nothing of create really virtuous ones.
Karen, I'm listening to all of these challenges, right? Like housing insecurity, how it is disproportionately affecting women and families, the ways that there are barriers to economic mobility, the ways that we don't really value women's work or see women's labor in the same regard. Mm-hmm. And you are someone who is working in childcare, working directly with families where that access is critical. Karen said it's expensive to be poor. And so you see mm-hmm. families who are saying, we want to be in the labor force, but we can't leave our kids home. We have to have them in a yeah. safe place.
Yeah.
What are you seeing in the aspect of the work that you're doing with families, but also with childcare providers mm-hmm. who want to be that good place for families?
Yeah, so there's a great intersection between providing quality care for low and moderate income families, which is the mission of the Women's League Child Development Center, and having a workforce that is made up of women of color who are earning low wages themselves. So you in fact have the working poor providing childcare for the working poor. And so it's very common for many of my staff to be eligible for many of the benefit programs that the families that we serve are eligible for as well. And so for me as the executive director, it's really about how I can support the women in my workforce in going back to school and increasing their educational attainment. And at the same time, working to raise their wages, which is tough because if you raise the wages too much, right, that means you have to raise the wages of the tuition for families. So I think it's a great opportunity to look at how we have a structure, right, in childcare where the women that work in the childcare field are so passionate about what they do and how they care for children and educate children. And at the same time, creating those opportunities for them to advance. And while we're caring for children, providing families with that opportunity to work, go to school, go to training programs. I see those things as really intricate. But I do have a great sense of hope by the high quality education that we provide for children every day, that we can help stop that cycle, right? That if we can intersect with children at the most rapid point that their brains are developing and put them on a trajectory to have solid educational academic skills that keep them out of the achievement gap, the knowledge gap, the opportunity gap, all those gaps that are used to describe children of color, that maybe we can break this cycle.
I don't know if you can hear it if you don't already know. Karen is a lifelong educator. I'm so impressed by the work because you have served as a principal at every level, from preschool through high school. You have turned around schools that people said that'll be a waste of resources. But that hope that you mentioned shines through your work, your belief in families and community, but also puts people on the target to say, if you really believe in these kids in this community, then commit to the resources.
Absolutely.
So because Karen mentioned hope, I want to move to talking about what we do, right? What are some of the solutions? What are we seeing that's working? Jenny, a lot of the work that you do in Aurora is also about targeting philanthropy to make those kinds of commitments and investments. And I'm a bit partial because I really believe in the power of philanthropy to be able to have those conversations across spaces. When you think about the solutions, when you think about what needs to happen, what are the ways that Aurora, the conversations you're having with other organizations like She Leads Justice, how are you helping people to say philanthropy should invest in these areas because everything is so interconnected?
Yeah, I always start with the very appalling number that 1.8% of charitable dollars across the U.S., and we're talking $385 billion from individuals, corporations, foundations, 1.8% is targeted to programs that serve women and girls. And the hope is what we know, if we can move that number, right? Women and girls are the best investment you can make. How I met Karen Lott was that the Women's League was a recipient of Aurora's Giving Circle that brings together women to pool their resources. We've got a bunch of members here in the audience, right? To then make change in community, right? That's the power of philanthropy. And so we actually funded some of the educational opportunities that Karen was talking about for her staff. And what women's funds do is we also are looking for innovation in community. We can really put we are data driven. We think about the needs, what this report was telling us. And then we look for places that are working with women and girls and providing innovative answers, like let's educate the childcare staff, like, Dignity Grows that's working on period poverty, right? As a economic factor that we haven't talked about tonight, a kind of extra obstacle for women and girls. We funded Girls for Technology and they're building for equity this year. That is all about getting seed money to women of color entrepreneurs because they don't get access to venture capital, right? They get 0.2% of venture capital dollars. So what we as Aurora try to do is take this data, think about, okay, what are some innovative solutions that we can help communities that are for communities to tell us, here's how we're going to try to address this change.
Karen Walton, let's talk about solutions. Mm-hmm. Because when it comes to housing, there's a lot of finger pointing, right? The developers say it's a zoning issue. The zoning boards say it's developers who aren't really committed to the community. And residents are saying, somebody do something so that we have access. Elm City Communities, the agency that you lead, has made a deal to purchase a vacant property across from Union Station in New Haven. That will be a game changer, not just for New Haven, not just for Connecticut, but really becoming a national model of what can happen when you make a commitment to build with dignity. Share with our audience some of the plans for that property and also how it helps us see the possible solutions to what is often a big challenge.
I'm so glad that you talked about all of the different voices that are engaged in trying to find solutions, because that is our approach, is that this is not going to be solved by any one single action. That the crisis we're in around housing on affordability here is caused by many different factors. And so we're going to need to have a set of solutions that targets that. Housing production is a big piece of that. We need more housing. If you want to bring the price of something down, you have to have greater supply, so that supply and demand principles of economics can work in a way that favors the consumer. So we need more supply in what we do when we're rebuilding communities and doing it in a way that creates real inclusive communities that absolutely includes affordability in there and real affordability, such that people aren't paying more than 30% of their income, aren't paying more than what they can afford toward their housing costs. That is what allows folks to live and also do the other things of life, pay for other things, have fun, joy. All of that is part of life that should be available for people at any income. And so our redevelopment at this parcel, formerly known as Church Street South, will be about creating more housing production. And as a state, we need to do the things that drive greater housing production. We need to address those exclusionary zoning that keeps housing production hamstrung and limited. We need to be advocating for the investment in housing at state bonding and an increase in funding for housing production. So those things all need to happen. And we've got lots of ideas about ways to incentivize cities and reimburse cities that are actually taking a step in that. And we think we need to do that. The solutions have to address the income aspect as well, right? We have to help make housing more affordable. We also have to help people have more income toward that. I'm so happy to be on a panel with a child care expert and to talk about these issues, because we need to think creatively about the ways we bring housing and child care together. One of the ways, there are some innovative things happening in New Haven where provider really would have loved to increase the pay, struggled to do that, got philanthropic support though, to invest in the housing, is able to boost the income of the childcare provider by providing free housing to the staff. So it's not a higher paycheck in wage, but it absolutely is increasing the family spending ability because they've decreased their housing expenses so much. We need to bring together solutions like that can do that while we fight for, we need to get oriented, $15 minimum wage. Yay, Connecticut, for moving forward. But we can't stop and think that that is in any way sufficient when the housing wage in this community is over $30 an hour. Mm-hmm. The amount it costs to rent a modest, not luxury, a modest two-bedroom apartment requires you to be earning $30 plus an hour in this state. So we need to be pushing for things like that and Fair Work Week and things that will help people increase their income. Child tax credit, which I'll let Emily, I know, talk about more. And then while we're in this awful market, we have to have protections for renters. So right now, things are too skewed toward the owner, toward the developer, or toward the property owner. We have to level the playing field for the renter with eviction protection measures and things that will help people stay in their housing, not get discriminated against by a past eviction. Evictions are becoming like incarceration for Black men. That is what eviction for Black women is becoming. We need to be guarding against that, real renter protections and a whole host of things that can protect our tenants while we're in this really tight market.
That was Dr. Karen DuBois Walton, president of Elm City Communities.
Jenny Stedman is Executive Director of Aurora Women and Girls Foundation. Karen Lott is Executive Director of the Women's League Child Development Center. And Emily Byrne is Executive Director of Connecticut Voices for Children. Coming up, more from our live panel. The panelists tell us what we should focus on going into the 2024 election. This is Disrupted. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. This hour, we're airing a recent live conversation on inequities faced by women in Connecticut since the beginning of the pandemic. We focus on childcare, housing, and economic mobility. Our panelists are Dr. Karen DuBois-Walton, President of Elm City Communities. Jenny Stedman is Executive Director of Aurora Women and Girls Foundation. Karen Lott is Executive Director of the Women's League Child Development Center. And Emily Byrne is Executive Director of Connecticut Voices for Children. I asked Emily to talk to us about some of the policies that are working in Connecticut.
You know, I would say that there are some truly innovative things in the ether, but the vast majority of the policies within our lexicon are not what I would call innovative. They'd be what I call important and necessary. Some examples are things that Karen just talked about. There are amazing advocacy organizations fighting for land use and zoning reforms. I think another example of fundamental great things is Husky for Immigrants, which provides more access to healthcare for residents throughout the state. She Leads Justice, formerly known as Quelf, is leading the charge on paid sick days, and a group of advocates, including Bridgeport Generation Now, fought for the early voting measures, which of course matter because all of these policies will ultimately be determined by our elected officials. So these are things that I would call like fundamental policies that are critically important. When I think of like truly innovative policies, I tend to think about innovation as being birthed out of necessity. So today, folks aren't making enough in wages to meet the rapidly growing pace of rents. So we're seeing innovations like the Connecticut Tenants Union and what they're doing to build power with renters and residents across the state. In a similar vein, Connecticut was the first state to pass a right to counsel program, which helps provide protections for renters right on the verge of eviction. I think the legislature showed it was possible to do big things when it passed that policy. It needs to be expanded and funded, but already the benefits are proving to be good. You know, there's the guaranteed income pilots that are happening at the city level, which are being led by 4CT and the Connecticut Urban Opportunity Collaborative, which the Big Three community foundations are a part of. One of the things that we did as an organization was fight for a tax gap, state tax gap analysis, because we know that the reality of our revenue situation in the state is that all of these policies, whether they're innovative or not, are going to require considerable and we hope equitable state resources. Connecticut baby bonds, we supported this. We should be really proud about this. This is a policy that is not only innovative, it is a model for the rest of the country, what can be done in terms of combating generational cycles of poverty. I think it proves that we don't have to be the land of steady habits. I think it showcases that transformational change is possible. I think the movement around this is just super exciting. I love it. I think it's the best thing that the state has done.
Karen, you were appointed to the governor's Blue Ribbon panel on child care. And Emily, I believe you worked with that group as well. I know that the panel has released some of its initial findings and recommendations, more to come before the end of the year. What are some of the solutions that the panel saw that were working and that we need to really scale up and out? Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things that you are most excited for that came out of that work?
Yeah. So I would like to believe that it's not recommendations to scale up, but to redesign and to fix a system that's been broken for a very long time. I think the recommendations that are going to the governor are really looking at how to address the affordability of childcare for many families, expanding eligibility for Care for Kids, which is a state-funded program that allows families to offset some of the cost of their childcare expenses. So it's not a silver bullet. It's not going to solve everything, but I think it is a step in the right direction. And I think just the fact that the governor is talking about childcare, that he developed this panel, is very different than the conversation that was happening pre-COVID. And I think one of the other things that I'm hopeful about with the recommendations is that it's looking at how to support the current workforce in gaining more educational opportunities. I think it's a well-hidden secret that for young women and maybe young men, we just don't have many men in the childcare field, but it is a great gateway. Early childhood education is a great gateway to becoming a public school teacher. Mm-hmm. And so it's a non-traditional route, but I certainly have had young women in my organization who use some of the funding provided by Aurora to go and complete their associate's degree, complete their bachelor's degree, and then guess what they got? Teacher certification, and left me to go to the public school. I say you have to go to grow, so I don't fault them for that, right? But it's such, I think it's a untraditional pathway that we necessarily don't think about.
I want to bring in Karen Du Bois Walton here because, Karen, you chair the State Board of Education. What are the partnerships, again, in the idea of solution, what are the partnerships that are happening? Of Karen talking about, I'm seeing this pathway from the perspective at the State Board, what are the partnerships that are happening there?
Yeah, right. One of the other things that the pandemic really brought to light was what's happening in our classrooms. We saw we were already in a situation of a crisis around teacher vacancies in our K-12 public education. And we saw lots of educators make choices coming out during the pandemic and coming out of the pandemic to do other things. And even, you know, more teachers leaving the classroom. So again, in your innovation is driven by necessity kind of thing. It's put the State Department of Ed and State Board in a position of being very creative about thinking about how are we certifying educators and what do we need to do? And the reality is the regulations around how you become an educator have not been updated in any comprehensive way in decades. We are at the table, and the beautiful thing is that our commissioner of the Office of Early Education is part of this planning process and at the table so that we're building a system that thinks about education, educator certification from the early childhood through post-secondary. It can't be lost on any of us that when we were in the throes of the pandemic and there were thoughts of big federal spending bills and everything was in that federal spending bill, there was huge energy around early care. And there were going to be huge, massive investments in early care. And there was huge discussion about housing. And there were going to be huge investments in housing. And through the negotiations, as you saw, what ultimately passed in the bill and big infrastructure bills and other things that got over the finish line around climate and things that are important. But what was left on the cutting room floor there were the very things that are so impacting Black and brown women, women-headed households. Child care got cut, was not in the final Recovery Act bills. Housing cut, right? Those are the things that weren't in there.
Jenny and Emily, as I'm listening to Karen talk about how fleeting our public attention can be and how quickly we move on from our public commitments. So that in 2020, we were talking about the pandemic and all of the things that we needed to do to support essential workers and vulnerable people. But we also saw a lot of virtue signaling about people's commitment to equity and justice, where people were fighting to see who could put up the biggest banner without any substance to the banner, but wanted to be able to say, I'm on the right side of this. So much of that has also gone away. A group that I think will not allow that to go to the side, young people, who really hold us accountable in powerful ways. From the perspective of the work that you're doing, from what you're seeing and what you're leading, what's your message to young people as takeaways? So I'll start with you, Jenny, and then go to Emily.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we're talking about hope and joy, I think about young women. I think about their commitment to a world that looks different than the one that they have, that they are not going to take the kind of status quo kind of leadership that we've seen. I think it's super exciting that when we get young women engaged in the political process, I think that there is incredible power and potential in electing more women to office. If you really want to see policy change on childcare, on women's economic opportunity, on housing, what you need to do is elect more women.
Emily, I can hear Patty Russo and Glenda C. Carr in my head saying, yes, yes, elect more women, support more women. But what's your message to young people?
I mean, we don't have to tell young people anything. They are just out there doing God's work, right? Like it's just so wonderful seeing how they have become our moral compass. And provided really a shining light, I think, for all of us, you know, older folks. So I would just remind us, right, that we are not without agency. We have a choice to make Connecticut a better state. Women, girls, right? We are so critical to our economy. We are so critical to our communities. We're so critical to our families. And I love that we're having this conversation, especially, you know, in light of the conversations that are happening in Congress, where folks are talking about eliminating the Women's Bureau from the Department of Labor, right? I think, you know, what I appreciate about the report that it is alluded to here is that women are just simply amazing. We are industrious, we are resilient, we are caring, and even when the systems are designed to keep us down, we figure out a way to rise up. And that's not an excuse to perpetuate our existing harmful systems. It's a reason for changing them, because imagine what we could do if the decks were stacked for us.
We are heading into a pivotal election year. And while a lot of people are talking about 2024 and the presidential election, I want to remind you that there are important races at the local and state level, in addition to congressional races. Given the work that you do, given the priorities, how they create really a future for women and girls, I want to ask each of you, what's something that we should be focusing on or demanding as we head into the 2024 elections? Karen, let's start with you.
I think the data that we've talked about that's been shared tonight is the type of data that needs to be shared with our elected officials and to hold them accountable for changing some very systemic issues that are impacting women and girls. And like Emily just said, if that energy that is being put into mere survival could be put into thriving, what a wonderful place our communities could be, how much stronger our families could be, what a stronger state we would have. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why I'm passionate about the Aurora Foundation is because women and girls make things happen. And when we support women and girls, we really support families, we support strong communities, we support the change agents in our world. And so I think we all have that agency, that responsibility to hold our elected officials to say, look at how these issues are impacting women. Look at the eviction impact on women and their children, and what is the impact of women leaving their educational pursuits with huge amounts of debt that then creates another cycle for them. So I think we all have that opportunity and that awesome responsibility to take the data that we've learned and to learn more about it and to use it to educate those who are in positions of power to make changes.
Opportunity and responsibility. Emily, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I know I'm supposed to say the child tax credit, and I do think that's really important, just like child care, just like affordable housing supports. But I'm going to say a thing that I actually think is relevant to all of our issues, and that's around revenue. You know, at Voices, we believe that justice is a horizon, not a destination. And so it really, for us, it requires that leadership be consistent and, you know, persevere. And so I think the thing that we need to ask our legislators, our elected officials, folks that are asking for our vote, is to be brave. These things cost significant resources. Mm-hmm. And the state, we have to fund them like public goods. And so that requires some really difficult decisions. And, you know, we often get into this debate that is very deficit-minded, very zero-sum game, and we have to really do everything that we can to fight that urge to be in that negative space. We should stay with, you know, and I know it's hard, we have to stay with an abundance mindset that these things are possible. We are a very resource-rich state. The question is, are we willing to tap those resources? And so that is the thing that I would think that we need to really be pushing for, is to ensure that our elected officials are going to be brave enough to do the right thing, not the politically convenient thing.
Bravery. Karen DuBois, welcome.
I hope that you feel charged up around the urgency and the scale of each of the issues. Personally, the one I'll speak to right now is around housing. And I hope that you'll leave here charged up, not with the feeling that this is a problem for them, for some other people, but that you'll leave here charged up that this is a problem for us. These are our communities, and that our communities are suffering by our continuing patterns that were rooted in segregation and exclusion, and that we're all suffering in it. And so to the get involved, the get involved is absolutely in your local elections and that kind of thing. But the get involved is the fact that land use decisions about what's happening in your town are happening each and every day. And the voices are being heard loudly each and every day, and they may not be voices that reflect the things that you value. And too often, folks who are trying to do the things that allow for more production of housing, that allow more inclusion in communities, are drowned out by a small number of anti-voices that we call the not in my backyard, the NIMBY voices, or the banana build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone voices in communities. And we've also done polling. We know that's not the majority of voices. Majority of people actually want these changes. And so my call is to get involved, to let your voice be known, and to drive for some of the change that we need to happen.
Thank you. Jenny.
I am also going to call out She Leads Justice, because they helped me. I actually wrote some testimony that they helped me share with my legislators. It's not hard, and it makes a real difference. Like, there are ways that we can all contribute, right? We can all be part of the solution. We can all be in a better place if we insist that there is equity, if we insist that there's justice. Then we can build the kind of world that we want our young people to have. While they are inspiring and they are doing a lot of the work, it is still on us to build the world that we want to see for them. And focusing on women and girls, we're focusing on the most vulnerable. And when we make sure that they have what they need to thrive, then we all will.
Jenny Stedman is Executive Director of Aurora Women and Girls Foundation. Dr. Karen DuBois-Walton is President of Elm City Communities. Karen Lott is Executive Director of the Women's League Child Development Center. And Emily Byrne is Executive Director of Connecticut Voices for Children. The conversation was recorded at Quinnipiac University. We'll have a link to the Elusive Equity Report on this episode's webpage. You can find it at ctpublic.org/disrupted. Disrupted is produced by Kevin Chang Barnum, Wayne Edwards, Meg Dalton, and Katie Tularski. Our interns are Letitia Peters and Joey Morgan. Special thanks to Meg Fitzgerald, without whom this event would not have been possible. And a very big thank you to Mark Contreras of Connecticut Public, to Quinnipiac University, Aurora Women and Girls Foundation, the Community Fund for Women and Girls of the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven, and Connecticut Data Collaborative. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Thanks for listening.